Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter and attorney based in Washington, and I've the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009 when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep, and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
This is Lamar Waldron, the author of Ultimate Sacrifice and Legacy of Secrecy, those two books, the latter of which will become a movie produced and starring Leonardo DiCaprio in 2013. And you are listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson on Underground Progressive Radio.
This is Les Leopold, the author of How to Make $1 Million an Hour, and I just want to tell you that you'll get a rich and rewarding experience by listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Greg Palast, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book Vultures Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores, and you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Schaefer, author of Sex, Mom, and God. You're listening to Carson's Corner, a show I enjoy. I hope you enjoy it too. I encourage you to listen.
And welcome to this live Sunday night edition of Carson's Corner in conjunction with the CommonsProjectNetwork.com right here on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Bob Carson. Pleased to be with you on this very, very important show here today. We're going to do something a little different today. Okay, it's not going to be just the format where I rant for an hour or so, which I enjoy doing. I enjoy every minute of this broadcast. It really is therapeutic for me, and I know it's informative and entertaining for you. We're going to change it up a bit here. We're trying a few different things here. And in just a little while, we're going to give you an interview that we had with Joe Burns in 2011. I believe sometime, I don't remember the exact month in 2011, but I was just looking through my books that I have here, and I came across this book, Reviving the Strike, which really is probably the best book that I've read on labor in a long time. It's very, very important because, you know, the state of labor hasn't changed over the past, you know, 5 or 6 years, okay? And in all likelihood, the way we're going, it's not going to change. It'll just continue to be the same as it has been, an eroding, countervailing institution to complete corporate power. Right now we have only, by some estimates, 7% of the private workforce that is unionized. We have a much higher percentage of public sector workers that are unionized, which is why public sector workers are on the verge of extinction. You know, that there's going to be a Supreme Court case. I'm sure that's going to answer the constitutionality of public sector unions. I told you, you know, this is no surprise to anybody out there. Public sector unions, where there is organizing, there is collective power, because wherever workers are organized, that's collective power. That's part of the countervailing institution, institutions, the, you know, in America, that are supposed to protect the rights of workers, who are basically in distinction. You know, they're basically a declining breed. And as Chris Hedges, the famous progressive journalist and author, said, humans have no intrinsic value to corporations, and I think that's absolutely correct. And so it's only natural that corporations seek to really immobilize workers. And so this dynamic is not changing. It's only going to continue. In fact, I think it's going to get worse. It's even getting worse right now. If you look at the current state of the Republican Party and their view on labor, you know, wanting to abolish the National Labor Relations Board, all of this is just, it's just getting worse for you and I, you know, because anytime organized labor is diminished, you know, our rights, our pay, our benefits, our power get diminished as well. It's no secret. If you want a middle class society, whatever that means, if you want a you know, society in which workers actually have some input in the process, then you need to have an organized workforce. But right now, in the United States of America, it is practically illegal to unionize. We have these so-called right to work states, which, as Tom Hartman points out, are right to work for less states, where you know, organizing is collecting dues is virtually made illegal. You have a union busting industry that, you know, billions and billions of dollars that these corporations pay these union-busting law firms and so on to, you know, propagandize the workforce and to you know, kill any type of drive to organize. In fact, Leo Gerard says that, you know, corporations, you can have the right to try to unionize, and corporations can do whatever they can and want to stop you. You can have the right to try to vote, to have unionization in the workplace, and corporations can do whatever they want to stop you. And they have everything at their disposal to try to contain labor, because one of the arguments that Joe Burns makes in reviving the strike is that we have a system of labor control in America where the laws are written, the laws are enforced, and the laws are interpreted to contain labor in America. That's what it's come down to. And so this is a very, very important book, because it takes a critical look at organized labor in America. And it lays out some ways in which organized labor has failed. You know, as the system has changed in America, organized labor has become, you know, the leaders have become more and more conservative and are trying to work within a system of labor control that inevitably will lead to, you know, their demise. It's like, you know, just trying to delay the inevitable, the way organized labor and leaders think and react. And you know, one of his main points in this book is how the strike is all but dissipated. You know, back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, when you had an alternative to capitalism, you had a real, you know, organized power base in labor, you had strikes. There were violent strikes. There were different types of strikes that limited the mobility of, you know, employers and stop production, because that's what corporations only care about. They only care about losing money. That's it. And, solidarity and all sorts of concepts that are now basically foreign to American workers. And so this is a very, very important interview. And it's one that, you know, you could play 5 years from now and it'll still be just as important as it was in 2011, because President Obama has done nothing to promote organized labor. You recall he ran on the Employee Free Choice Act, okay? He quickly gave that up. No attempts to revive that piece of legislation. In fact, Paul Street, who's a blogger, professor, and author, has chronicled how, you know, the passage of the Affordable Care Act and some of the funding mechanisms were at the expense of organized labor. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. And so, you know, the Democrats certainly are no friend of organized labor, maybe a little bit more sympathetic to, workers. But by and large, they're no friend of organized labor. And so, it leaves us with, a real, I want to say, need to have a radical change in America. And so we're going to play that interview. It's very, very important. We're going to try to get him on the show again, because I believe that there was some talk about him releasing another book. So we'll try to get him on the show in the future. But that's what we got coming up for you here today on Carson's Corner. And if you want to give me a call, you can at 347-326-9749, 347-326-9749. This interview is about an hour long, okay? And this was when we were on Underground Progressive Radio, which we're not on Underground Progressive Radio. This is pre-recorded, okay? And I really hope you enjoy it. Some very, very important points are mentioned in this interview, and I encourage you to get the book, Reviving the Strike. And also, if you go to revivingthestrike.org, you can find out more information about how you can get this book and everything. So without further ado, here is my interview with Joe Burns from 2011. And we'll be right back here. We also have the chat room open. I'll be able to communicate with you while the interview is going on in the chat room if you desire. So here it is.
You are listening to Underground Progressive Radio. This is Carson's Corner, and I'm Bob Carson, your host. You heard me talk a lot about how important organized labor is to our economy, and more importantly, our middle class. The United States of America used to be a very different country prior to Ronald Reagan. We had three times the amount of unionized workers in the private sector. Reagan in 1981 cut taxes drastically on millionaires and billionaires. He appointed his anti-labor buddies to the Labor Department and busted up PATCO. He deregulated the savings and loan banks, raised taxes on the poor and middle class 11 times. And as a result of the so-called Reagan Revolution, we went from an economy built on manufacturing to one that is now built on finance. And when an economy is built on finance, it's subjected to bubbles and busts, as we've seen over the last 30 years. Reagan left this country with a nearly $3 trillion national debt. We had the strongest middle class in the world, and now we have a middle class that's been virtually extinct. Prior to Reagan, CEOs made 30 times the lowest paid worker. Now that number is up to 500 times. We were the world's largest manufacturer of finished goods. Now we're last in that department. So the question is, how do we turn all this around? How do we go back to what we were prior to Ronald Reagan? And one word that I think sums up everything, to sort of simplify a very complex situation, is organize. If we organize, money cannot organize around us. And that's so important. We are very fortunate to be joined by Joe Burns. He is the author of the book Reviving the Strike, How Working People Can Regain Power and Transform America. I encourage everyone to visit his website at www.revivingthestrike.org. He's also a labor attorney. Joe, welcome to Carson's Corner.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
No problem. It's a pleasure. Before we talk about your book, tell us what got you interested in the labor movement in the first place.
Well, I grew up in a working-class neighborhood in North Minneapolis, and growing up in the 1960s and 70s, you know, I was able to, you know, we were able to have a pretty good life thanks to the labor movement. I went to the University of Minnesota, and my first involvement with labor unions was going down to support the strike of meat packers in Austin, Minnesota, back in 1986, the Hormel strike, which was one of the big strikes of the 1980s. So I learned a lot about strikes and how the system worked through that. And then following that, I became a hospital worker and eventually local union president. This is all prior. Then subsequently, I went to law school.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, it seems that you have a lot of familiarity with working folks, labor unions, and you mentioned just how different it was, how good it was. The labor unions were so good to our economy back in the 60s and 70s, and then everything really seemed to turn around in the 1980s. In your book, you talk about this concept of effective strike. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I was looking at is how come the strike today is so ineffective, but the strike that was employed from the 1930s through the 1970s was so powerful, and in fact so powerful that it was able to transform work in entire industries and in fact transform the economics and politics of the nation. And, you know, so that really became the big inquiry of my book. And what I discovered was that the strike of decades gone by differed fundamentally than today's strike. And the two main areas that it differed in was that the strike traditionally was able to stop production. That was the whole point of a strike, was that workers would go on strike, they would stop the plant from being able to produce, and that would force the employer to agree to a reasonable settlement. And the other thing about strikes back in the from the beginning of trade unionism up until, you know, the 1980s, was that workers didn't strike alone at one isolated factory. They struck together, at times, entire industries. So when you talk about an effective strike, you're really looking at those two factors. You know, one is solidarity, and the other one is the ability of the strikers to stop production.
Yeah, and you know what's amazing? I had on Richard Levins about a year or two ago. He's a labor economist. He's a former professor at the Michigan University, I believe, and he wrote a book with Stuart Acuff of the AFL-CIO, and they pointed out that really, you know, back then you used to see tens of thousands of strikes, and now, I mean, I think since the year 2000, there's only been like 181 strikes in America, which I think is a symptom of the balance of power. I agree with you. Workers have to effectively strike, but I think that the economy is much more different now than it was, you know, prior to Ronald Reagan. I mean, in 1935, of course, we had the Wagner Act passed. We saw the rate of unionized workers increase. Now in America, the private sector unions have been virtually dismantled. I mean, I think only 7% of our workforce in the private sector is unionized. And we have such a loose labor market with a 9.1% unemployment rate right now that workers really don't have any power anymore. And it's really unfortunate. I mean, we have a corporate mindset in America that we have to make the shareholders profitable. And the best way for employers to do that is to cut the cost of labor. That's why we're seeing offshore, and, you know, really for the last 30 years. So do you think that plays into it at all, just the dynamics of our economy, how our economy has really changed, that, you know, we're not seeing effective strikes anymore?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that the economy has changed since the 1930s, and that provides special challenges for trade unions. But then again, that's always been the case for trade unionism. You've had shifting forms of work, and you've had shifting economies that trade unionists had to deal with. And they either dealt with them or they suffered. So I think what we're seeing today, though, is if you look back to the 1930s and you say, well, how was it that during the 1930s, when you have unemployment in double digits and you have these massive corporations that are using spies in the workplaces and all this government repression, how come back then workers were able to mount an effective strike and to form unions and eventually transform the United States? And I think it really goes to a couple things. And the main difference between then and now is back then trade unionists used an effective strike, and today you can't say that.
Well, another thing, too, I think that after the Great Depression, the American people really understood what happened. I mean, you know, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt raised taxes on the rich, Americans cheered him. I mean, when he gave that speech in Madison's, Wisconsin, when he talked about how he welcomed the hate of corporations, I mean, he got like a 6-minute standing ovation for that. And once he did that, once he raised taxes, I think that started to, you know, shift the balance of power. You know, as I talked about in the intro, right now our tax policies overwhelmingly benefit millionaires and billionaires. There's no question about that. Corporations are paying no taxes. So what's happening is, you know, the very financial elite, they're taking their savings and they're investing it in, you know, anti-union campaigns. They're investing it in the stock market. And another thing, too, that you brought up that was very interesting on how, you know, workers can adapt to the economy. We always have shifting economies. Paul Krugman wrote a lot about this, and he said, yeah, you know, we've increasingly become a service economy really over the last 30 years, but you would think that in the service industries, they would be highly unionized. It's the exact opposite. I mean, you know, Sodexo USA is a huge U.S. corporation. They're a service company. They basically manufacture or they distribute processed food. There's almost no unionization with that company. Walmart is, I think, the world's largest or America's largest employer. There's no unionization in Walmart, or very, very little, and, you know, we've shifted, but if it wasn't political and if it wasn't, you know, an issue of power, I think we would still see unions in our service industries. Why do you think it is that we haven't seen a high level of unionization in our service industries?
Yeah, I think what you really need to look at and what I focus on in my book to a fair degree is the role of legal restrictions in preventing successful trade unionism. So when you look at industries such as the service industry or trucking or meatpacking, those are industries where you can't really just look at the global economy to explain the decline of unionism. You really have to look at the shifting nature of the law. And as you pointed out, in the 1930s and 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was passed. And after it was passed, employers refused to follow it. So for the first 2 years of the Act's existence, it was met by a campaign of lawlessness on the part of the employers. They refused to bargain with unions, refused to recognize the unions. So what working people did is they ended up having to take matter into their own hands and enforcing the law. So they engaged in, for example, a massive wave of sit-down strikes that involved 400,000 workers in thousands of workplaces across the country, taking over their workplaces and demanding their rights under the law and their human rights in order to strike. Eventually, the law was upheld by the Supreme Court, but immediately following that, employers started to attack the National Labor Relations Act, working to undermine it. So you saw between 1937 and 1947, there was, I believe it was 230 amendments of bills introduced in Congress to gut the National Labor Relations Act. Employers understood that if they could change the rules of the game, that they could win battle after battle. Eventually, they succeeded in passing in 1947 the Taft-Hartley Act.
Right.
And what the Taft-Hartley Act did was it outlawed some of the most important features of trade unionism, the main one being solidarity, workplace-based solidarity. They outlawed the very tactic that made it possible for trade unions to flourish in the preceding period. So you fast forward, and I won't go through all the details, but by the time you get to the 1980s, you have a situation where if workers go on strike in the 1980s, what would happen? That you would basically put up a picket line at a plant, you'd be limited by injunctions to stand there with one or two picketers, and basically the scabs would be going in and the products would be going out. You wouldn't be striking an entire industry. You'd only be striking one plant of a giant corporation. So basically, workers from the 1980s on have been fighting with their hands tied behind their back, and that's one of the key things we need to challenge.
Right, and my point is, I just think that our economy, our tax rates, our trade policies are instrumental in aiding workers and allowing them the freedom to effectively strike. I think that has a lot to do with it. And another obstacle I would say that gets in the way of employees really having effective strikes is our corporate media. I'm sure you're well aware of this, what's been going on in Wisconsin and Ohio and other places. I mean, we've seen hundreds of thousands of people marching in the streets in Wisconsin, in Ohio, and yet our corporate media has yet to feature any guests from labor on any of the Sunday shows. Isn't it difficult for workers of America when, you know, so much of America views the media through the eyes of a corporate lens and corporations are receiving, our corporate media is receiving donations from corporations who are anti-union, you know, CBS, ABC, NBC. To the best of my knowledge, they put up a resistance when it comes to their employees unionizing. So doesn't that just make it that much more difficult? I mean, back then in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, you didn't have Fox News. Now we have Fox News. We have right-wing talk radio. So how does that play into the mix?
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. I think the slogan is the media is not close to corporate America, it is corporate America.
Right.
And it makes it extremely difficult. You have a massive upsurge like that went on in Wisconsin, and you see it hardly covered in the corporate media, and it was an extremely significant event. On the other hand, 1,000 Tea Party members protest somewhere, and they give that wide effect. So, that all poses great challenges for unions, and as you pointed out as well, all of these economic policies and trade policies have worked to undermine trade unionism as well. So if you look at certain industries, you can explain part of the decline of trade unionism to conscious policies on the part of the government. So all of those factors are things that we have to look at. I think when we're looking at solutions, we obviously have to look at the political solutions as well, but we also have to look at, the workplace organization and the ability to directly confront employers, and that's where I come back to the strike.
Absolutely. We're talking with Joe Burns. He is the author of the book Reviving the Strike, How Working People Can Regain Power and Transform America. When we come back here on Carson's Corner, I want to talk about the current state of our economy, and we'll also get into more of what's in Joe's book here on Underground Progressive Radio. Stay tuned. We're back here on Underground Progressive Radio. This is Carson's Corner, and we're speaking with Joe Burns. He is the author of the book Reviving the Strike. please visit his website at www.revivingthestrike.org. I want to talk about the current state of our economy. We've been kind of talking about it a little bit here, but my theory is that the economy is exactly where the rich want it to be. The wealth and income in this country are highly consolidated. The tax policies overwhelmingly benefit the rich, our trade policies, you know, so on and so forth. I mean, you have the Chamber of Commerce. I remember during the Bush administration, the Chamber of Commerce, they were actually writing the Bush tax policies, and they were writing, or you had Enron that was determining the Bush energy policies. So it's so important that we make these fundamental changes in order to free up the burden of the burden that's facing workers today. Joe, when do you think Americans are really going to get it? I mean, most Americans have a favorable opinion of unions. Okay, if you look, most American workers would join a union if they could. But, you know, we're seeing just a lack of enthusiasm when it comes to unions that we saw. I mean, really, we saw in the 30s and 40s, like you mentioned, when unions all across America would stop working. When do you think Americans are finally going to get it and we're really, really going to have a watershed moment in this country?
Yeah, well, I think that's where a lot of trade unionists drew a lot of inspiration from what happened in Wisconsin, because what we saw in Wisconsin was what the right wing thought was that they were going to be able to isolate the public workers, that they were able to convince everyone that the public workers were overpaid and that they shouldn't have pensions and so forth. And what happened is by standing up and organizing and getting out into the streets, the working people through their unions and outside of their unions were able to transform the terms of the debate. And that's what really needs to happen. And they were able to make the issue not about public employees and their salaries, but about the very idea and the right to engage in collective bargaining. And what poll after poll showed was that the public supports the right of workers to have input into their terms and conditions of employment through bargaining. And they were also able to shift the terms of the debate, so it became very much about the role of corporate power in our democracy and the subversion of democracy. So part, I think, of how we're going to, you know, change the terms of the debate has to be through organizing and people getting out and shifting the paradigm, because the media is not going to allow it in. We really have to push it through ourselves.
How do you think Obama has been when it comes to organized labor? I mean, I think it's safe to say that, you know, the major unions out there are frustrated because there wasn't anything done when it comes to the Employee Free Choice Act. He did make a couple appointees to the National Labor Relations Board. Craig Becker, I thought, was a good appointee. But by and large, Obama has been very, very, I want to say, lukewarm when it comes to the labor issues in America. He's been reluctant to support the workers in Wisconsin and other states, which some see as a good political strategy. I don't know, but, you know, how would you rate President Obama when it comes to organized labor?
Well, I don't think he's been very good for organized labor. I think he, you know, early on, he joined the bandwagon of bashing public employees when he supported the firing of the teachers in, I think it was Rhode Island, early in the year. And he did very little to defend collective bargaining. Beyond that, you know, the offered lukewarm support for the Employee Free Choice Act, and if you look at the health care bill, now what do we have coming out of there where it treats certain, you know, union-sponsored plans as Cadillac plans, even though they're not Cadillac plans by any stretch of the imagination. These are plans with deductibles and copays. So there's a lot of reasons that union members are upset, and what you see is in the press in recent weeks, AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka becoming increasingly vocal about the failure of the Democrats to support us and talking about the need for a labor movement that's independent of both parties and pushing its own interests.
Exactly. And that's sort of where I was going to go. I mean, you know, we see this in Britain. You know, when Maggie Thatcher came into power, it was a couple of years prior to Ronald Reagan, and she really went after the coal miners industry. She decimated the coal miners industry, and other union industries were afraid to go up against her, and they sort of formed their own party, the Labour Party, in Britain. And I'm wondering if we could sort of see the same thing here in America, because I think the attitude of the Democratic leadership is that, you know, organized labor, they have nowhere else to go. Where else are they going to go? They're going to have to support us in the end, and they seem to take labor's support for granted. So do you think that's possible? Do you think that in the future it's possible in America that we could see a labor party?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible in the future. I think it's a long-term effort. During the 1990s, there was an effort by a lot of trade unionists to form a labor party. And just like now, when some trade unionists are upset, or many trade unionists are upset with President Obama, during the 1990s, many trade unionists were upset with Bill Clinton, primarily because of the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, which Bill Clinton pushed vigorously, and which had a devastating effect on unions and manufacturing. So following that, you know, there were, you know, some national unions who got behind the effort. There were a couple of conventions, and it had some steam, but it eventually ran out of steam. And then once Bush came in, I think the focus became getting him out. So hopefully at some point we will redevelop that momentum, because it's pretty clear, as one trade unionist used to say, Tony Mazzocchi, the bosses have two parties. It's time for workers to have one.
Exactly. That is a very, very good point. I mean, because ever since the decipled, Bill Clinton was no friend of the American worker. I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, and even at the time when NAFTA was ratified in Congress, I mean, you had people there are people, there was one author, I forget his name, was on PBS, and he's the author of the book The Trap, and his name escapes me right now, but he was saying that this is really going to destroy the American worker. This is going to destroy the manufacturing landscape of America. And then you had Laura Tyson, who was part of the Clinton economic team at that time, debating this guy. And she was saying, no, this is going to be great. This is going to create millions of American jobs. And you know, this was in 1994, and now look where we're at. I mean, I'm here in New Jersey. If I take New Jersey Transit all the way down to Washington, D.C., every 400 feet there's an empty factory, and it's really, really depressing. It really is. We just don't make anything here in America anymore. And you know what's funny is that Laura Tyson, I believe, is still part of the Obama administration. So Obama has surrounded himself with people that are corporate Democrats. I mean, Jeffrey Immelt, who's his economic advisor. Jeffrey Immelt, of course, is the chair of GE. GE makes 50% of its profits overseas. They're not interested in creating American jobs. You've got someone like Bill Daley, who is an investment banker. He was a board member of the Chamber of Commerce. They're not interested in labor. They're not interested in American manufacturing. They believe in trickle-down economics, and they believe our country should be run by the finance industry. So it's pretty discouraging when you look at Obama's economic team.
Yeah, and if you look at what is shaping up to be one of the major union battles of this year, it's going to be the struggle at GE, where multiple unions are in bargaining. They were bargaining last week in New York, and they are facing an employer who's demanding that they take massive cuts in their health care plans. And so that's really the type of people that Obama has surrounded himself in. And by doing that, you're really, you know, giving us a signal about which side you're choosing, because there is a, you know, there is a struggle going on here in this country. It's all too often one-sided with corporations against working people.
We're talking with author Joe Burns. He is the author of the book Reviving the Strike, How Working People Can Regain Power and Transform America. Please visit his website and pick up this book at www.revivingthestrike.org. When we come back, I kind of want to go a little bit more into the book, if there's anything else that you can tell us about that is really interested or really interesting in this book. I intend to pick it up. I love labor books. I think they're so important. So when we come back from these messages, we'll talk about it with Joe Burns here on Carson's Corner. We're back here on Underground Progressive Radio. My name is Bob Carson. This is Carson's Corner. We're speaking with Joe Burns. He is the author of the book Reviving the Strike. Joe, how long did it take you to write this book? How many pages is it? And you know, what other interesting tidbits are in this book maybe that we haven't gotten to?
Okay, I first started writing the book when I was in law school, because when I went to NYU Law School, and I kind of I really learned a lot more about labor law and how explicitly political a lot of these judicial decisions are, and how anti-worker the fundamentals of labor law are. But following that, I didn't start writing it until a couple of years ago. And during that period, I had spent another decade engaged in collective bargaining and increasingly saw the importance of reviving the strike. Because when you sit at the bargaining table, you can make all the arguments you want to make with these corporations, but obviously the only thing that they care about is the bottom line. And logic or reasons or appeals to morality really don't work. So I started, researching and thinking about the book. And originally, it was a lot more about labor law. But as I went on, it became more and more about union economics and union history and rediscovering some of the traditional principles of strike theory, which really was able to produce a strike which made major gains for working people. So we were able to, in the period from the 1930s well into the 1970s, have a strike that could take a job like meatpacking, which, before the 1930s was a low-wage hellhole, as described in The Jungle, in the famous book The Jungle. But from the 1930s on, workers were able to make it a safe job that paid upper working class wages comparable with manufacturing jobs and make it a desirable job and made it a job that could really center an entire community. And you saw the same in trucking and steel. And when you look at how were workers able to do that, you really have to look at the role of the strike, because workers struck and they struck repeatedly in the 1950s. In the 1950s, there were an average of 350 major strikes per year. And a major strike is over 1,000 workers. In the years 2000 to 2009, that had plummeted to a mere 20 strikes per year. So you go from 350 major strikes to 20 strikes, and the 20 strikes were a lot shorter and less effective than those in the 1950s. So that was really one of the keys to me in thinking about this book, is how can we recreate a strong labor movement? And I became more and more convinced that in order to do that, we had to look at the role of the law in preventing successful trade unionism, but more importantly, to look at what is our way of thinking? How do we view a strike? What do we view as important and successful tactics? And that's really where you get to one of the central points of the book, which is we need to rediscover the true meaning of the word solidarity. And solidarity has always been the greatest strength of the labor movement. Solidarity is workers directly supporting other workers. and we need to redevelop a labor movement which is capable of engaging in true solidarity. And to do that won't be easy, but and it probably will take a fundamentally different labor movement, one that's willing to engage in the types of civil disobedience that's going to be necessary to make major change in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. And your point about solidarity is so well taken because, you know, I think it really goes back to 1980, you know, the whole Reaganism, the idea that we're not a society. We're a collection of individuals. There's no such thing as a society. I mean, I was talking about Maggie Thatcher a few moments ago. Maggie Thatcher famously said there's no such thing as a society. And, you know, it's this type of mentality that has really taken a control over our elected officials, okay? I mean, all you have to do is just look at our policies and look at, you know, corporate profits. We're the only country on the face of this earth that allows corporations to rake in billions, if not trillions of dollars in profits. I mean, Walmart one decade earned $1.6 trillion in profits. The Walton family has a fortune. You know, they have a $38 billion fortune. This is the only country in the world that allows that. And the reason that we allow that is because we have adopted this philosophy of greed is good. You know, if everybody is acting in their own self-interest, then that's going to benefit the mass amount of people in this country. And we know that's not the case. And this message is beaten into us. I mean, ever since we were children, you know, we're always told to be the best. It's always about, you know, the competition. We have to be the best, and you have to get there at all costs. And you know, it's just that message is pumped out there by the media who you know, glorifies millionaires and glorifies the rich and glorifies, you know, these people like Donald Trump who really, if you look at them in their life, they're really kind of immoral people. I mean, Donald Trump, taking him for example, Donald Trump for 2 years didn't pay federal income taxes. You know, his casinos in Atlantic City in New Jersey, where I'm at, routinely take from the poor and give to the rich. I mean, there's a law here in New Jersey that all casino earnings that come from, you know, patrons, at least 1.25% of that has to go back into the community and has to benefit, you know, the community, not just in Atlantic City, but it has to go back to the state for things like housing, so on and so forth. They take that money to the casinos and they just, you know, they reinvest it in their casinos. They don't give it really back to the community. And you know, it's just this philosophy that's so prevalent throughout our society that, you know, we all have to be a millionaire, that's really killing us, Joe.
Yeah, I think you're right to focus on some of these big ideas. And one of the things in my book is I have a chapter called The Principles of Labor Rights. And what I did was I went back and looked at what we consider the conservative trade unionism of the American Federation of Labor in the early part of the 1900s. And what you find is the labor movement upheld a principle that said human labor is not a commodity. And what they meant by that was that to employers, human beings are just things. Human labor is just a thing. It's just an input into the production process, no different than soybean or oil or lumber. But the trade union movement has always believed that, you know, human labor is different because it's part of our lives. And it's how workers spend a good portion of their time. So the labor movement, you know, fought for decades to get that principle respected. And they even passed it into United States law as part of the Clayton Act in 1914. So the law of the land says human labor is not a commodity. But what you see today is that employers believe just the opposite. They believe that workers are expendable, that workers can work their whole lives in a plant, such as in New Jersey, the empty ones you're talking about, and that they can just, you know, take a profitable plant and close it and ship it overseas just so that they can make even higher rates of profit. And that's a really immoral system and an immoral economy. And we really need a labor movement and a broader workers movement in this country that can really reinstitute a better, more morally grounded economy. And to do that, you're not going to convince these people because, frankly, like you say, they're motivated by greed. And in order to really redistribute power in this country, wealth and power, we need a trade union movement that's able to take on employers. And, you know, hopefully, you know, my book is, you know, part of the contribution to rebuilding that type of labor movement.
My friend Tom Hartman, who's a great progressive host, often says on his radio show that corporations are kingdoms and unions are perfect democracies. And I mean, unions aren't perfect, but I think the basic concept of a union as far as collective bargaining represents a democracy. You know, we're always told, Joe, that this is a free country and we're you know, it's a free market, free enterprise, free. But a majority of Americans want to unionize. Poll after poll shows that. If given a choice, the American worker would want to unionize as opposed to not unionize. And if you look at our private sector, only 7% of workers in the private sector are unionized. So how in the world can we say that we're a free country when we don't allow our employees to unionize? Leo Gerard recently pointed out, Leo Gerard is the president of the United Steelworkers Union. He recently pointed out that the United States of America, in terms of its application of labor laws, is one of the worst countries on the face of this earth. I mean, we recognize union busting as a legitimate profession when in every other country in the world, union busting is illegal. I mean, so it's just, to me, it's unfathomable that this is going on in America right now. You know, our laws and everything, our philosophies, it's just really, it's almost too much to take at one time.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the wording of the National Labor Relations Act, it's very protective of workers' rights. But what's happened over the 70-plus years since that act was passed during the Great Depression, it's basically been gutted by corporations using their influence in Congress and in the judiciary and in the administrative bodies to adopt a series of interpretations that have basically gutted the act so that it's no longer protective of workers' rights. So if a worker wants to organize a union, they face incredible pressures from the employer. The employer can threaten them. They routinely fire workers for organizing. So you're exactly right. How can we say that we're living in a free country when one of the most basic human rights, which is the right to band together and organize for a better life, is not protected?
Another thing that kills me, too, is just the level of prosperity or the lack of income growth when it comes to American workers. From 1980 until I believe 2007 or 2008, it has been shown that 80% of the income growth has gone to the top 1%. And you look at, you know, American workers in general, they are the most productive workers on the face of this earth. I mean, we work longer hours than, you know, any citizen in the European Union. We have less vacation time. We're more productive. And so, you know, if an American worker is more productive, if they're producing 2 to 3 times the amount of work, shouldn't they be paid more? I mean, isn't that the whole idea of America, is that you work more, you produce more, you get paid more, right? You get paid what you're worth. But instead we see, you know, American workers, you know, working like dogs or working like slaves, and they're not getting paid what they should be because of the various issues we've been talking about. Isn't that redistribution of wealth, Joe? We hear this so often from the people that are opposed to unions, that unions, that's just redistribution of wealth, redistribution of income. But if you have an American worker that's doing 3 times the amount of work and his pay has stayed the same since 1980, where is that money going?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, since as you point out, since the Reagan era, wealth has been distributed in this country, or redistributed, but it's been redistributed upwards. One of the reasons that's even stated in the National Labor Relations Act when it was passed in the 1930s is that it's to level out the income gap in this country and distribute wealth differently, because they understood in the 1930s that one of the causes, the chief causes of the Great Depression, was that wealth became too concentrated in too few of hands, and that the vast majority of people who work for a living weren't able to afford the products that they had created. So they realized, as a part of social policy, that we should encourage trade unionism. Today we're seeing exactly the opposite, where we have this elite in this country who seem to just want to get more and more for themselves and don't really care about the social consequences of their decisions.
We're talking with Joel Burns. He's the author of the book Reviving the Strike, How Working People Can Regain Power and Transform America. Please visit his website at www.revivingthestrike.org. IG Publishing, they are a labor-friendly publisher, correct?
Yeah, they're an independent publisher. They publish a variety of books, including some literary fiction and also nonfiction. Not necessarily all labor, but they are labor-friendly.
And that's always a reassurance that there are at least some publishers willing to put books that are written by people that are labor-friendly, because, you know, so many of the political books that we see in this country are, very many of them are right-wing. I mean, I can recall going into Barnes & Nobles or going into any bookstore here in New Jersey or anywhere, and just mainly the books that we see are of right-wing authors, and I think that's unfortunate. You know, I have to, if I want to read a labor book or a book that's favorable to labor, I have to ask around. You know, I have to email my friends on Facebook, hey, do you know of a good labor book I can get? And oftentimes they struggle to answer me because there's just not a lot of literature on labor out there. So it's good to see a guy like yourself get the support of a publishing company and able to, you know, to get out there and get the word of organized labor out there and get the history correct and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, IG Publishing is a great little publishing house, and, you know, that's what it really takes, because a lot of the major publishers don't want to touch the labor issues, just like the corporate media doesn't. So, it's very difficult to get a labor-themed book out there, and that's why it's great that, folks like you have these radio shows and are willing to engage in discussions that a lot of the other folks in the media aren't willing to do.
What type of reaction? You're on your tour right now. You're in Washington, D.C. at Busboys and Poets. I think you spoke there yesterday.
No, I was in Backpage Books in Waltham yesterday. I'm going to be in Busboys and Poets in Washington, D.C. on July 6th. I've been traveling around and speaking. I was at the UE Union Hall in Chicago, and I was over in New Haven. So I've been speaking to workers around the country and other folks, and been getting a good reception. A lot of the issues that I raise in the book are things that even within the labor movement you haven't heard much discussion of. When you tell folks you have a book called Reviving the Strike, at first you get maybe some strange looks, but once you start talking about the issues and the economics and the history, we've had some really good discussions.
Absolutely. And to what extent do you think labor been corrupted by big business? I mean, you know, I know people on my side of the aisle that are just as fed up with labor unions as they are corporations. They view, you know, labor unions as corrupt, and they say, oh, the upper management of these unions are corrupt and they're on the take. To what extent has corporate America infiltrated unions?
Yeah, I mean, you know, frankly, a lot of the problems with trade unions is self-created. We have unions that grew flabby over the decades and became undemocratic and unresponsive to the needs of the members. So that's why, you know, it's always been important to have organizations fighting for union democracy and fighting for the rights of members to make our unions fight better and harder for us. Although, I think you talked about it before, you know, even an imperfect union is still more democratic than any employer. So that's one thing you always have to keep in mind. But we need unions that are responsive to the members and willing to fight for their interests. And, you know, that's a struggle that we have as well.
Absolutely. And I, you know, in New Jersey and all over the place, we've seen public sector workers really be under assault by Republican governors. I mean, anywhere there's a Republican in the state house and there's a Republican-controlled legislature, they've gone after collective bargaining on the public sector, because the public sector is much more highly unionized than the private sector. And, you know, people become envious. You know, envious of pensions and health care plans and wage increases or salary increases, because in the private sector, there's no such thing as pensions anymore. There's no such thing as raises anymore. So people look to the public sector and they're really, really jealous.
Yeah, I mean, 20, 30 years ago, no one looked to the public sector and was jealous. It's just that the employers and corporations have been able to take away pensions and good health care for the vast majority of private sector workers, and they consciously try and stoke resentment against the public sector workers, although in reality what they're really trying to do is get people to fight over the crumbs while they pocket, you know, all of the money. But, you know, in the long run, you know, we can't have a trade union movement that's just based in the public sector. We need to organize the 93% of private sector workers who aren't in unions, many of whom, as you point out, want to be in unions, and we need to develop forms of unionism that can improve their lives, because ultimately that's when the trade union movement has grown, is when they've been able to offer workers the chance of a better life.
You know, the idea is to bring everybody up in wages, not everybody down to one lowest common denominator. I get so frustrated when I hear these Republican politicians talk about how much teachers make and how spoiled teachers are, and so on and so forth. Meanwhile, we have, you know, CEOs making, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. Stephen Jay Helmsley of United Healthcare made $470 million in stock options. John Paulson makes $2 billion a year and pays no taxes because he carries his interest over. The idea that teachers and public employers or public employees are somehow spoiled in this day of corporate greed is just absolutely offensive. But, you know, surprisingly, Joe, you have some people that believe this. There are some people out there that listen to right-wing media, listen to right-wing talk radio, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, so on and so forth, that believe that we have to go after teachers and firefighters and police officers, and we have to eliminate collective bargaining. I mean, isn't that amazing? Isn't it like paying half of the middle class to devour the other half?
Yeah, I mean, it's disgusting that folks would, of all people, pick on teachers to go after. You know, people who work extremely hard raising our children. And, you know, really, it wasn't really the best choice, because I think what you saw in Wisconsin is that people, you know, may have concerns about this or that, but they do like their teachers. And most people recognize the value of the work that that teachers and other workers do. So, but yeah, I think that's really their plan, is to try and pit the workers against each other. There was a whole thing about that was going around on social media about the 7 cookies that the rich guys
yeah.
had, and then had the other people fighting over the crumbs.
Yeah, the joke was that there was a Tea Party person, a CEO,
oh, yeah.
and a union rep around a table, and there was a plate of 11 cookies. And the CEO takes 10 cookies And then he points to the teabagger and he says, "That union rep is after your cookie."
Yeah.
I mean, it's absolutely brilliant. It really is. Joe Burns, thank you so much for spending the hour with us. This has been a great discussion. Your book is going to be the next book that I'm going to read. Right now I'm reading a book called Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. It's by David K. Johnston, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. He's just absolutely amazing. We're going to try to get him on the show. Your book is the next book I'm going to read, and you know, I thank you for writing it. I thank you for your passion and your insight, and I wish you the best of luck on your tour, and hopefully we could speak to you sometime down the road. Please give us your contact information, any social networking sites or any websites that you feel may be pertinent.
The site where I have some of my articles and links to my book is www.revivingthestrike.org. I also have a Facebook page called Reviving the Strike. You can reach me on through.
Well, thank you very much, and I really, really appreciate it, and we'll talk to you sometime down the road.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
This is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
That's right. You are listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson. Pleased to be with you back live here after that great interview with Joe Burns taken a few years ago in 2011. Made a lot of great points. And, you know, it's one of those interviews where you don't know where to start. It's like there's so many great points and so many, you know, important facts and statistics and thoughts, and it's just unbelievable. It really is. And, you know, I mean, I didn't write anything down, but you know, we spoke about President Obama and how, you know, someone like Laura Tyson, who was really one of the people that Laura Tyson was on the board of one of these financial institutions, and she ultimately made money off of the 2008 financial meltdown. And years before that, she was on PBS touting free trade and how NAFTA was going to bring millions of jobs back to the United States. And this is the person that's, you know, advising President Obama, which shows you exactly, you know, what President Obama's team, what they believe in and how they are essentially part of the problem. They are no friends of organized labor, okay? President Obama, as was pointed out in the interview, hurt organized labor. He supported the firing of the Rhode Island teachers. He froze the pay of federal workers in 2010, did nothing. We mentioned, you know, Wisconsin, the protests in Wisconsin. President Obama was nowhere to be found when it comes to supporting organized labor in Wisconsin. President Obama, you know, aside from making a few appointments to the National Labor Relations Board, which Joe Burns points out, has been neutralized. It's been neutralized. It's been nullified by corporate power, all as part of the system of labor control, where, again, you know, because we allow these corporations to run wild and the very wealthy and so on, the labor laws that were intended to protect American workers have been, you know, gutted and now serve as a system of labor control that immobilizes American workers. You know, under current labor law, an employee or an employer can shut down a factory, can offshore a factory, completely close down a factory, can hire replacement workers to replace those that are striking, can, you know, have an assault on union drive campaigns. I mean, just fill in the blank, any number of tools at their disposal to contain and eliminate labor. And this is how our law is set up now, where capital is more important, inherently more important than labor. Labor, as Joe Burns said, is treated as a commodity. It's treated as a cost of production, no different than, you know, rubber, lumber. It's a commodity traded on the open market. And it's not treated as human life, you know, morality, fairness. It does not enter into the equation in our economic system in America. It just doesn't. And, you know, a good indication of this is the stock market and stocks. It's the end-all, be-all. It's companies and CEOs now, the CEO compensation system in America, which allows a CEO to be paid 300 to 500 times the lowest paid worker, and treats that CEO as, you know, first and foremost a stockholder, and they're doing what's in the best interest of the company stock. Is an example, is a clear example of the immorality of our system. So where a CEO, you know, that works for a company for 30, 40 years is almost unheard of in today's society. CEOs are essentially gamblers now trying to increase the company's stock at the expense of the American workers. And now things like offshoring, you know, merging, cutting costs, cutbacks, attacking pensions, all of these things which hurts workers, which impacts solidarity, is treated as a good way to do business, good for the company's earnings. Do you see how perverse our system is now? You know, where it's hurting workers, offshore workers. Workers are disposable. They're an encroachment to business. They're, you know, what's his name? Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman points out, the corporate media puts forth this view of the world from their perspective, and this influences reporting. It's everywhere. It's one of the reasons why I don't watch corporate media. I don't own a television. I don't read corporate newspapers. I get my information from the internet, which of course we know is under attack and will be under attack. But you know, the reason why is because corporations treat a wage increase as a cost of cost to business as a negative factor. This is how it's presented to American people out there, and it's absolutely disgusting. It really is. But I bring up President Obama, and I bring up his administration's contempt for organized labor as a way to show us that, you know, things are just not going to get any better, because we still have over half of the American people that voted for President Obama. You know, President Obama won election twice, and he's the, I believe, one of the few presidents out there to win election, win his second election with over 50% of the vote, which shows you that, you know, we're a long way from solidarity in this country. We're a long way from changing how we view business in America and changing how we conduct, you know, our economic practices in this country. This is it's really, really bad news. It really is. So this is a very, very important stuff. Joe Burns, visit his website at revivingthestrike.org. We hope to get him on the show in the future. You know, I got to tell you, it's almost March now, and in another week or so, I'm going to be going to Atlanta, Georgia. I have to do my residency for my educational program. I'm working on another college degree, and as part of my curriculum, I have to serve a residency, and there's, you know, residency examination, thesis, a dissertation process, all these different things. And now, you know, the winter's over, presumably, although we are supposed to get some snow later on here on the East Coast this week, maybe Tuesday, dust up. I'm hearing conflicting reports. But one thing I got to say is the roads, and I'm sure wherever you are listening, you can attest to this, the roads are in absolute horrible shape. The roads in America are just deteriorating. And sometimes when I'm on these roads here, because I live near Freehold, which is about maybe 40 miles south of New York City, maybe 45, and the roads sometimes look like roads you'd see in Somalia, for crying out loud. Not maintained, potholes everywhere, and it's just getting worse. It really is. And this is costing Americans billions of dollars each year. Because we have a deteriorating infrastructure in America, our infrastructure is among the worst of industrialized nations. Okay, we have infrastructure that was constructed during the Civil War, for crying out loud. We have bridges collapsing. Okay, this is not uncommon in America. We have potholes galore. We just, you know, have buildings that are just, you know, not up to code and everything. This is costing us billions of dollars in tire maintenance, in wheel alignments, and I'm sure anybody out there can really attest to this as well. You've probably paid several hundreds, if not thousands of dollars, maintaining your vehicle because of the poor condition of our roads. And this is universal. And, you know, why is it that we're not repairing our roads? Why is it that we're not repairing our infrastructure? If you look at what China's doing, you know, China has a much more significant investment in their infrastructure. They have more, you know, high-speed rail than we do. They have more skyscrapers than we do. They've actually created more jobs than we have, a lot more jobs than we have 3 or 4 years. And granted, I mean, they have a wider working population. It's much more, more people in China than there are, than there is here in the United States. But still, you know, you get the point. You look at other countries like Germany. Look at a country like South Korea, which 40 years ago, South Korea was the equivalent of Kenya in terms of their GDP, in terms of their infrastructure now. South Korea is a great country that really we should look to. Why is it that we're allowing America to crumble in front of our eyes, that infrastructure spending is almost treated as a social welfare program? Well, I would submit to you that the reason why we're allowing this to happen is because tax dollars, how our tax dollars are spent, are a result of political will in America, okay? The political will dictates where our tax dollars are going to go. You know, for example, I spoke about this on our last show, how several universities in America that at one point were tuition-free universities, you can go there for free, have been privatized. Professor David Harvey spoke about CUNY University, how you know, this was at one point a free school where someone like himself can get a doctorate degree. I don't know if he went to CUNY University, but he's a professor there, without having to be an indebted servant. Now that this university has been privatized at the behest of the Rockefeller brothers, who didn't want their tax dollars to go to this university because maybe they didn't like the ideas that were expressed at this university. Maybe they thought of this as Lewis Powell did of the liberal indoctrination system, which really is a pervasive thought among libertarians in our society, which is why the Koch brothers, the principal financiers of the Tea Party, have donated millions of dollars to something like 400 different schools across America, injecting their radical neoliberal ideology and everything. And so, the wealthy ultimately decide that we don't want our tax dollars to go to, supporting schools and supporting public services. And Chuck Collins calls this the cycle of disinvestment, where, the political will is not there to fund public services. Congress, our senators, our House members spend so much time dialing for dollars and so much time, raising money from the very wealthy that all they hear is their political interests. And you know what? Oh, I don't want to pave the roads. We don't want to upgrade our highway system. We don't want to upgrade our bridges. Oh, that's just, I want that money to go to this business interest or that business interest. I want to provide a tax break to this corporation or that corporation. And when all is said and done, we have no more money to rebuild our infrastructure, and you and I are poorer as a result, because if our infrastructure was repaired, if we actually did take care of this country, then we wouldn't have to spend several hundreds, if not thousands of dollars each year on vehicle maintenance. It's just one example, one way that we pay for them, that wealth is redistributed upwards. And this is a way that we can't see it, that the corporate media and the American people cannot see this. They can't draw the connections there, because let's face it, our country is not that politically sophisticated. The average American out there, honestly, doesn't care about these issues. They care about sports. They care about reality TV shows. They could probably name you a member of the Simpsons cast as opposed to, who their congressman is, and much less what is being debated on in Congress. They don't care about this, but they know those welfare recipients, right? They know those the welfare queen who's at the supermarket using her food stamps card to buy soda and buy cigarettes, right? And they're breeding like jackrabbits. They understand that because they could see that. And the corporate interests exploit this ignorance and exploit this distorted picture of how our tax dollars are allocated to basically get the masses to ignore infrastructure repair and how that ultimately is redistributing wealth upwards. I wish these Tea Party people out there, these fascist Tea Party people out there that, you know, are just so ignorant and so filled with hatred. I wish they could understand that, and they could start to have rallies and start to really understand, you know, why they're spending so much money out of their own pocket and how they're becoming poor and the elites in our society are becoming rich because of you know, things like this. It's really remarkable, but it's really a shame. It's so depressing. I mean, you know, think about what it's like to go on one of these secondary roads or, you know, in some cases, main roads and just seeing pothole after pothole. You've got people in America that don't want to even drive at night. They don't even want to drive because it's so dangerous out there that you're going to blow a tire. You're going to, God forbid, get into an accident because the road you're driving on is something we'd see out of Somalia, or if not that bad, then definitely approaching that condition. It's just one more example of how America is deteriorating, how we are crumbling. And I reported on this last month or last week during last week's show about how the amount of money that we spend for things like unemployment insurance or Social Security or you know, FEMA, any one of the areas of government spending that is relatively minuscule compared to what we're spending subsidizing the banks. Someone making $50,000 a year is spending over $800 in subsidies to banking institutions. Thousands of dollars each year we are personally spending subsidizing the oil companies, subsidizing the farm industry, where, you know, you have the nation's wealthiest Americans receiving, you know, taxpayer dollars to grow certain products and to not grow certain products. You know, even some people like Bruce Springsteen, who doesn't live too far from where I'm broadcasting now, he's the recipient of, you know, government tax dollars, as is John Bon Jovi, and so on and so forth. This is what's bankrupting the American people, and this is why Americans, by and large, have very little disposable income. You couple that with the fact that Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. You've got 3/4 of Americans that are living paycheck to paycheck. And, you know, what emerges out of this is a society in which we have right now, where this country is just becoming, we're downgrading ourselves. We really are. And it's really, really depressing. But, you know, pick up Joe Burns' book, Reviving the Strike. It's very, very important. I also want to make an announcement about what's going on over at the commonsprojectnetwork.com. Our good friend Brad Hulhut of Pinko the Bear Radio, who is now under the banner of the Authority Smashing Hour, which is another great show on the commonsprojectnetwork.com. They have their show here on Blog Talk Radio. He was on a show this morning called Bear Man Radio, which is another progressive radio show that Brad speaks very highly of. Brad has been working with these individuals for years now. I've not listened to them. I wasn't aware of their existence prior to today, but he's actually going to be welcoming them to the commonsprojectnetwork.com. And that's very, very important, because the more content we have on there, the more shows, the more powerful we are. And, you know, we maybe can create an alternative to the corporate-owned, corporate-driven media model on cable news and even on Sirius XM, which is really, really depressing. So we want to welcome them, Bearman Radio, to the commonsprojectnetwork.com, and encourage you to support the commonsprojectnetwork.com. This is Carson's Corner. My name is Bob Carson. You could friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. Follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/BobCarsonMMA. And like the Carson's Corner Facebook page at Carson's Corner 13. That's facebook.com/Carson's Corner 13. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, show some respect.